second part of Esther chapter 1.
So from verse 10. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was high in spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Bittha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zetha, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the beauty and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of the law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king: Karshina, Shethar, Admathar, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Media, who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan replied, in the presence of the kings and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed through all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands, from the least to the greatest. The kings and his nobles were pleased with this advice. So the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in his own script, and to each people in their own language, proclaiming that every man should be ruler over his own household, using his native tongue.
Well, according to the Guinness Book of Records, the largest wedding reception ever was hosted in India by a former Tamil Nadu chief minister and movie star, who hosted a reception banquet for over 150,000 guests at her foster son's wedding in 50-acre grounds in Madras, India, in September 1995. So the wedding is reported to have cost over 750 million rupees, which I'm told is around 23 million US dollars. A fortress topped with cannons and winged mythological creatures was constructed from plywood at the entrance of the wedding grounds. And the three-mile drive from the temple to the grounds was strewn with rose petals and lined with 600 Grecian columns strung with coloured lights, along with giant papier-mâché models of Indian princes. Well, this event just 27 years ago seems not dissimilar to the pomp and plenty of King Xerxes over 2,500 years ago when throwing a huge banquet, which we saw last time and you can read about in the early verses of chapter 1, particularly around verse 6. And I say this really by way of introduction and recap from where we left off. It was a few months ago now. Back then we got up to verse 9, where Queen Vashti had her own banquet for the women. Still in the royal palace, but we have no details to suggest a banquet that was as ostentatious and impressive as the one the king was throwing in the palace grounds. The king was trying to project an image, and very successfully, I would think, of extreme wealth, power, and authority. and at a much more modest level than what's recorded here. I remember attending functions at various embassies while living in America, each country trying to outdo the other and make their event the one to remember. And these were considered really important events in terms of projecting an image to other countries, and it all contributed to the pecking order in which countries were viewed. Well, clearly here, banquets were a big part of life during the reign of King Xerxes. And reference to such events is mentioned several times in the Book of Esther, which doesn't maybe seem strange or out of place until we realise the word is used far more here than in any other book, despite its relatively short, small size of just 10 chapters. Well, taking a small bit of Esther is not perhaps the easiest thing to do. And one commentator I read suggested not doing that because you need a knowledge of the whole. You know, it's a short story, really. And like all short stories, you would kind of read them from start to finish. You would read them in one sitting. And you almost need to do something similar here. You need to get the total picture because, you know, in isolation, this first chapter just seems a little bit random with a powerful king, a feast, too much to drink, and then a queen that is told she's no longer queen. But, and it's a glorious but really, that this is really the main point of the chapter, and that all of these events were happening in order that God could bring about his purposes to save the children of Israel again. The stage is being set for the drama to follow. So events are occurring here that will bring Esther to prominence as queen to replace Vashti. And from that position, she will be able to save her people. And this is something often referred to by Christians as the sovereignty of God, and which we considered in a bit more detail last time. But for the time remaining this morning, I just want to give some further reflections on this chapter from verse 10. Now, there's a number of themes in evidence other than God's sovereignty. Some say that Queen Vashti should be seen as a champion of women's rights by saying no in such a male-dominated culture. Others say that there are pointers here to the boundaries of authority in the husband and wife relationship. You'll be very relieved to know that I'm not going to touch on either of those two areas this morning. But there's three areas, in fact, that I do want to consider, relate them to the passage and then to ourselves. So there are three points. They're very simple points. The first one is alcohol. The second one is anger. And the third one is advice. So it's three A's, but I don't think King Xerxes will be getting any A's by the end of the chapter, as I think we shall see. So let me just read again the first couple of verses that Christa read in verses 10 and 11. So it says, on the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zetha, and Carcas, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. So here we have, as a backdrop, the lavish feast that was put on by the king. He had power and authority. He's basking in his own glory. And it's probably not a stretch to say that he was pumped with pride by the reminders all around him of the vastness of his kingdom and just how important he was. So all is settled. Life is good. Xerxes is reigning happily on his Persian throne. And then the view we have here just narrows, doesn't it, to a particular time in his reign. And not just a particular time, but a particular and very specific event in verses 10 and 11. Now, while the impact of alcohol is not the main point of the chapter, it would just seem remiss not to refer to the cause of this great upset in the king's palace, which has been preserved throughout history in the Book of Esther for all to read. Well, I don't want to go into great detail here because I know that Spencer covered this a year or two ago in another series. I hope he'll forgive me for not remembering which one. But just a couple of comments as we pass through. So I think I can say with some confidence that all adults within this room, or indeed listening online, will know of the dangers and power of alcohol, either through experience, and maybe that's bitter experience, or through reputation from friends, from news articles. surveys, medical analysis, and so on. And this is sometimes accompanied by anger, as we shall see. Indeed, the Drink Aware website states that according to police records between April 17 and March 18, victims believe their perpetrators to be under the influence of alcohol in 39% of violent incidents. Well, the king here comes across as really a bit daft, doesn't he, in the judgment displayed or the lack of it. And I'm sure many of us can identify with him. Whatever facade we show to others, particularly on a Sunday, I doubt that any of us would claim to always apply sound judgment in the decisions that we make, and I know I wouldn't. And King Xerxes certainly didn't hear. The command was out of place and heavy-handed, and so was the way it was carried out. Did it really need seven of the king's assistants to deliver a simple message to Queen Vashti? But here alcohol plays its part, and the dangers seem obvious, don't they, when people are sober? I remember a German saying that says, the truth is in the wine, or in the wine there is truth, because if you drink a bit too much, I'll know what you really think, and you're much more likely to reveal your hidden thoughts and desires. And to give some credence to that saying, it's said that the Soviet communist leader Joseph Stalin seldom drank himself, but deliberately lavished alcohol on his colleagues and officials in order to loosen their tongues and discover weaknesses he could exploit. Well, according to the Greek historian Herodotus, the Persians often made decisions when drunk, but it was a rule to reconsider when sober, a rule that seems not to have been followed here. So Psalm 104 is right, isn't it, I think, to state that wine gladdens the heart of man, but then I'm sure it's no coincidence that also self-control is one of the fruits of the Spirit encouraged in Galatians 5. So for those who drink alcohol, it suggests very strongly, doesn't it, that there is a balance to be struck. Well, I said I would only mention it briefly, and I'm done on this point, except to say this, that if anyone here finds this area particularly tough, or you've got yourself into a difficult place, do have a word with me, or send me an email. I'm in the church directory. You know, as Christians, I think we can both be more vulnerable in this area, and also better at covering it up. But positive change is always possible. So alcohol. Next, anger. And I'm just going to read verse 12. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. So the text states the king was furious and burned with anger. Now that's pretty strong language by biblical standards. I looked up the word and found synonyms including enraged, violent, fierce, and livid. Queen Vashti did not obey his command, and he will have also looked pretty silly in front of the men for whom he was the commander in chief. His authority had deserted him, and it was plain to see. So alcohol and anger seemed a bit of a pattern in the life of King Xerxes. We see that here in chapter 1, and perhaps we think that maybe he'd learnt his lesson and become more controlled as a result. But then we also see in chapter 7, verse 7, in response to another major event in the book, we're told that the king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. Well, drink affects people in different ways, doesn't it? Some people pair their wine with particular foods. King Xerxes seemed to pair his wine with anger. But back to chapter 1 and verse 12, we have a furious king, and I wonder what other path he could have chosen. An apology, perhaps, recognising that the command was out of order, or laughing it off and joking to others to say, well, see what a strong-willed wife I have. But Xerxes is about to publicise his stupidity throughout his kingdom, as the following verses describe. And just stretching this point about anger and relating it to ourselves for a second, talking more generally, I wonder if as parents we can sometimes fly off the handle at some minor misdemeanour, and that's without alcohol playing a part. You know, when taking a deep breath and saying, let's have a chat about it in an hour or so, might give us a better and more reasoned outcome. Let me give an example. It's not a personal one, though that wouldn't be difficult to remember. even though our kids are now adults. But a friend of mine gave me an example about when he got angry with one of his, and he'd been too harsh with one of his children. There'd been a recent birthday, and one of the presents they bought had been a skateboard, which they were dying to try out. But the child had done something wrong. Dad got angry and decreed that the skateboard would not be used in the coming week, even though it was half term. Well, after that, the favoured present was barely used, perhaps due to it being a reminder of an event that everyone now wanted to forget. You know, my friend told me this 20 years after it had happened, and he wished he could turn the clock back. And I'm sure parents here could give many more examples. I think we all recognise, don't we, that children need boundaries, they need discipline, but it needs to be proportionate. Otherwise, acting in haste may haunt us or give us pause to regret in our later years. I know William mentioned this briefly last week about sometimes wanting to turn the clock back. I don't think he's alone. I think every parent in this room would perhaps like to turn the clock back just over certain events that they hope they could replay. But back to Xerxes. He's here, he's incensed, and he's spitting with rage. I don't know if you've seen someone you know get really angry, and it's not a pleasant experience. You know, Christians who get angry will sometimes give you what I think is the somewhat lame excuse that their anger is somehow righteous anger and therefore okay. You know, it's not okay. Some Christians seem to firmly believe that they're right and they're speaking with God's authority, and if they get angry, well, there must have been a jolly good reason. Listen to this quote in a Christian book called The Heart of Anger, when the author's referring to hidden anger, you know, when people think that their anger is somehow justified. It says this: as far as they can see, their struggle isn't with anger, but it's all the people and situations that are causing them trouble. They're not cross, they're just ill-treated. The world needs to change the way it behaved towards me, not me toward the world. It simply never occurs to such people that the problem may be much closer to home. Well, if you'd have been an advisor to King Xerxes, I wonder what you might have said. Oh, king, why not sleep on it? Things will seem better in the morning. Or how about now, your majesty, calm down. It's not as bad as you think. Well, such responses may have led to Xerxes turning his anger on you. And someone has said that when anger is tied to power, there is great danger. And I think we can see the truth of that here and in the days in which we live. Well, I guess it's not hard for any of us to understand why he was angry. He, as king of a great empire, had been very publicly snubbed. Others have seen it. The image he wants to portray to his subjects, it just isn't there. The facade has come away. Only shame and weakness are left. You know, it's been said, hasn't it, that anger explodes. It goes beyond reason. It defies logic. Well, I'm sure we could all point to instances where this has been shown. You know, in Proverbs 12, verse 16, it says this. It says, a fool shows his annoyance at once, but a prudent man overlooks an insult. So I don't know if you're thinking of anyone that applies to, but it's certainly applied to King Xerxes. So alcohol, anger, now advice. I'm going to read the rest of this chapter again. So just bear with me from verse 13. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king. Karshina, Shetha, Abmatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan replied, in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and peoples of the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed. that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, and so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler in his own household. Well, advice. It's interesting here that the king asks his advisers what to do according to the law, simply because his own wife had not done something that he'd commanded her to do. Indeed, there was no law covering this, and the king seems genuinely perplexed. He can command a vast kingdom and a huge army and take them into battle, which we know from the writings of the Greek historian Herodotus, but he's stumped when his wife says no. Verse 15, he says, what must be done? And this suggests that he didn't feel the do-nothing option was a possibility in this on this occasion. I mean, in biblical and secular history, as a person and as a leader and as a king, he comes across as someone not really up to the job, and less generous commentators refer to him as something of a buffoon. Well, the king here had advisers who knew the law, and apparently we are told that they understood the times. They had special access to the king. Remember, even the queen could not come into the presence of the king unless invited to do so on pain of death. They needed to come up with something that would please the king and also, of course, therefore keep them in a job as well. And so they hold a crisis cabinet meeting, you know, something like a meeting of Cobra in response to the unfolding crisis. Partygate is not a new idea. But at our distance and view, though, it seems totally disproportionate, doesn't it? Ridiculous. But something, it seems, had to be done. And it appears there was no constructive criticism from within that circle of advisors, or none that's recorded here. The group are all named one by one, so you feel that any dissent would have also been recorded. You know, a bit like the Bank of England's decision on interest rates, where we know how the voting went. And it's been said, hasn't it, that if a leadership always finds itself in complete agreement, there may be something amiss. Something to watch out for in churches too, isn't it? If constructive criticism isn't welcomed, well, that's a danger sign, because such criticism, as long as it's delivered sensitively, of course, can often help shape better outcomes and relationships and therefore save a pile of trouble later on. And, you know, it's really easy to get things wrong, isn't it, in churches and in life. I've had a bit of experience over the years leading teams of various sizes, and there needs to be some sort of change. I construct and deliver the message, and I think to myself, oh, yeah, I think that went pretty well. I think that was good, you know. Do you know, I think it went so well, I'll ask one of my team to say, ask them what they thought. You know, searching for compliments, you know, how it goes, you know, just sort of discreetly. But the response, yeah, it was okay, yeah. I think so-and-so felt a little undervalued because, you know, while you stated the case for change really clearly, you didn't acknowledge all the good work that they'd done up to that point, to the change of direction. So instead of a slap on the back, it's a kind of slap in the face, isn't it? And quite well deserved, really. Well, I could have done with some constructive criticism there, a different angle, you know, checking that all bases had been covered. And a bit here would have really helped others' perception of the king. But the recommendation given to the king via Memucan was, we are told, received gladly. Legislation was the answer, and a law that cannot be repealed, verse 19. Those with the real control, the advisers, can smugly sit back after thinking they'd skillfully covered up another problem. And looking back from our vantage point, we can't help but coin the phrase that the king and the kingdom were being led by donkeys, which does seem a bit harsh on the donkey, doesn't it? Which is an intelligent creature, if a little stubborn. But the response to the king's request for advice was totally disproportionate. It was terrible advice. One commentator calls it out as a dumb decision. One event in the royal household between husband and wife led to an edict throughout the whole empire. And this was a vast empire. The sun never set on it, we're told. And the impact was almost instant. The queen must be banished and must never see the king's face again. In fact, the last time she's called queen is in verse 17. By verse 19, queen has been dropped and she's just simply Vashti. So the outcome was assured, apparently. The women will respect their husbands, verse 20, as if the king's edict here is going to really change what women think. And it seems from the names given in verse 14, there were no female advisers, which I know we would understand given the place and standing of women at that time, but the king could certainly have done with some to prevent such a ridiculous edict being issued. You know, many laws are passed, aren't they, in our own country, but it doesn't necessarily change people's attitudes and behaviours. I'll leave you to think about which ones that might apply to. Well, Lord Acton, who was a politician in the 1800s, was considered one of the most learned men of his age. He became famous for his observation that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men, he said, and there seems more than a degree of truth in that here. Well, the king's advisers may have understood the times and the law, verse 13, but wisdom in that forum seemed to be in short supply. And I think most of us would probably say it's a rare commodity in our day and generation. You know, I don't think we're told what the end of wisdom is in the Bible, but we're told the beginning, aren't we? And that's the fear of the Lord. Proverbs 9, verse 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So there's no end to wisdom recorded, because we never stop learning in life, do we? As a Christian, in so many ways, every day is a school day, a day to learn more wisdom. Psalm 49 says that a man who has riches, and that's King Xerxes, of course, a man who has riches without understanding is like the beasts that perish. And what is understanding? Well, we know that from the previous quote in Proverbs. It's the knowledge of the Holy One, knowledge of God, something not shown by King Xerxes at all. Well, I need to draw to a close, but in doing so, I just want to ask, where would you go for advice, for wisdom, or for understanding, as I alluded to very briefly, to the children? Do you just talk to people who will agree with you to retain your friendship? Do you perhaps go to the horoscopes, perish the thought? Or do you just go with whatever the kind of prevailing mood dictates? You know, advice that might seem good today, but not so good tomorrow. Friends, life is serious, isn't it? And there are many important decisions to make, and we don't want to get it all wrong. Maybe you don't need anyone or anything else. Maybe you know it all and you plough your own furrow. And if anyone disagrees with you, then, well, they must be wrong rather than you. Something I try to do if I've got a decision to make, a big one, I mean, not a frivolous one, something big going on in my life, I just try and talk to somebody who I know will be honest with me, somebody who can ask me good questions that either challenge or just maybe come from a different angle I'd not considered, not to outsource a decision and prevent me from drawing my own conclusion. But it's often good to get another perspective. Those conversations and friendships are invaluable. And what about the big question of advice on life and death? Where can we find wisdom and understanding with those? Well, it's right here in the Bible. You might say, well, I don't need all that mumbo jumbo. Well, many here would say, that's exactly what we used to think. But not anymore. There's real hope for life here and indeed for death. But maybe you don't think so. And you'd agree with this quote from a professor of philosophy and law at New York University in the late 1990s. He said this: it isn't just that I don't believe in God, and naturally I hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Well, Psalm 14, verse 1 says that the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. But if there is a God, what's the message? I'll summarise it very briefly. After God created the world, our representatives, that's Adam and Eve, sinned. We see that from Romans 5 and, of course, from Genesis. In doing so, the relationship between God and them as representatives of the human race was broken. And so whether we like it or not, our relationship with God is broken too. But God sent his Son, that's Jesus, to be offered as a perfect sacrifice for all sins committed, past, present, and future. Why him? Well, because during his 33 years on earth, he was without sin, didn't do anything wrong. He's sometimes referred to as a lamb without a blemish. You know, there's an old hymn that says there was no other good enough to pay the price of sin. Only he, that's Jesus, could unlock the gate of heaven and let us in. So how do we get let in? Well, by pleading with God to forgive us for all the things we have done wrong. We call it sin. The Bible calls it sin. To recognize that we've angered God by our sin. You say, well, he's a God of love, isn't he? Well, yes, indeed, but a God of justice too. And sin's penalty has to be paid. And we therefore seek his forgiveness by pleading with him, that he sees the sacrifice of Jesus made on our behalf, which we remember particularly, don't we, at Easter. And so if that's happened in our lives, we'll want to follow Christ and his message. We want others to know and experience it too. Christians want to give others every opportunity to at least hear the message. You know, we run a short course here. It's called Hope Explored and goes into a little more detail. You can ask any questions you like. There's another one starting on the 14th of September. It's just 3 sessions on successive Wednesdays. It's entirely free and there's no obligation to finish the course if you don't want to. But it shows that Christianity is about real hope, a joyful expectation for the future based on true events in the past, which changes everything about the present. Do contact me or the church office or website, indeed, if you want to know more. So, of course, some will say, well, it's a crazy message. Some will agree with that New York University professor. Some will say it proves that you're weak, that you're obviously a bit odd. But have you ever explored the Bible's message for yourself? It's all very well saying there'll be another star in heaven tonight when a loved one passes away, but what does that mean? Is heaven just a place of your imagination? You know, the best place you can think of. But if it's real, how do we ensure we have a place there? Or do you just think, well, I'll be me and hope for the best? Or maybe you think that it's just automatic. But friends, if it's automatic, what we're doing here and what thousands of other churches are doing up and down the country, it's just a waste of time. We might as well pack it in. It's not automatic, according to what we read here in the Bible. There's a personal call to each of us to respond to that message. So those of us here who believe, we believe by faith. We're looking forward to heaven. And what's faith? Well, Hebrews 11 tells us that faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Well, in Esther chapter 1, a woman stood up and said no, and the empire was powerless to enforce its will. But then being paraded as the king's object in front of hundreds or thousands of drunken men doesn't sound like an opportunity that many women would want on their bucket list. As it happened, the king lost his head and the queen lost her crown. In some ways, though, there's a conundrum here, isn't there? When we consider Vashti's response, was there any way she could have refused without losing everything? Should she just agree? Should she make an excuse? How do we retain influence in a hostile world as Christians? Do we say no to everything we disagree with in order to stand up for what is right? Or do we try and find perhaps another way to retain that influence? I'm not giving you the answer, by the way, that merits another consideration on its own. But the biblical author doesn't make a judgment on Vashti, and I don't think we should either. In later chapters, Esther keeps silent about her background and her Jewishness, which many fellow Jews may have been critical of. But in due time, God used that silence so that she could save her own countrymen and women, something she couldn't have done if she'd been open about her background. So it's not for us to question God's ways. The big picture of what's going on in the world and why, well, that's God's department. I wouldn't trouble yourselves too much by it. Our job is to ensure that our sins are forgiven and that we have peace with God. You know, a better path are the words of another old hymn, that I am not skilled to understand what God has willed, what God has planned. We know the truth of that, don't we? But this I know, at his right hand stands one who is my Saviour. So the book of Esther, it's a story of providence and indeed deliverance as God preserved the children of Israel. There was no Red Sea moment in this book. But you know, we've heard already, haven't we, that when God appears to be most absent, he can be most present. And such was the case here. Sometimes he works through the supernatural and gets very obviously involved, as in the Red Sea that I just mentioned. At other times, he uses ordinary events to bring about his purposes as is the case both here in this chapter and also later on in this book. I just want to read the first verse of the second chapter, because it seemed to me like quite a sad verse. I don't know what you thought, what you would think. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her.